Hi everyone, welcome to season 2, episode 2 of Social Anxiety Life podcast. Today we will be discussing children and social anxiety.
And we're really delighted to welcome our first ever guest to Social Anxiety Life. We'd like to welcome Sam Dalakia to our episode. Hey Sam.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. I can't tell you, it's such an honour and a privilege to be your first guest, guys.
Thank you for coming on.
And we'd like to start by giving you the opportunity just to talk about who you are, what you do, and how you can help parents, carers, and educators of children with social anxiety.
Absolutely. So, hi everyone, I'm Samantha Dalakia. I am the founder of SPD Tuition and Coaching. I am also the creator of the Behaviour Balance System and the Behaviour Bank. We run support for educators and providers alongside parents and carers. We also provide confidence coaching, get those words out, for children directly so that we can support the whole 360 when it comes to behaviour. And of course, all behaviour is driven by our emotions. So a lot of what we do is around emotional intelligence, supporting our grown-ups in managing and, you know, kind of really facilitating that emotional regulation when it comes to the young people around them.
Suppose a sensible place to start would be our very youngest children that come into a variety of settings. And I'm just imagining a child, maybe 2 or 3 years old, who's come into nursery for the first time and separating from their caregiver and then entering a setting with other children. And I suppose my question is there a direct link between separation anxiety and social anxiety?
So I guess when we are thinking about anxiety as a whole, our children experience it in a whole host of different ways. And I think, you know, when you have separation anxiety, that is a social challenge, isn't it? So when our children are struggling to separate from their, you know, their familiar, their, you know, the person that they know keeps them safe, of course that impacts their experience socially, because when they then go into the setting, when they try and interact or don't want to interact, they're going to be kind of keeping those emotions with them. So anxiety, you know, ebbs and flows, if you like, in terms of when it's experienced and how it's experienced, and in terms of the different situations that we have to navigate. And so when we think about our youngest children, particularly our toddler stage, there is a lot of anxiety around a lot of different things. Because when we think about anxiety, one of the key things that we're really dealing with is the element of control. And let's face it, our little humans have very little control in their day, let alone, you know, all the things they want control of. So when we think about anxiety, yes, we can, you know, look at it in different scenarios and different situations, and it can be absolutely situational based, but the emotion itself is there, you know, it's the same emotion.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible to differentiate between maybe a child who's just shy and a child who has social anxiety? And in your experience, have you noticed it more prevalent in certain age groups?
Yeah. So this is such a great question, because I think we talk a lot about stages and ages of development, don't we? And we look at, you know, where people, and there's lots and lots of studies around this, where people experience things the most. And of course, you know, looking at kind of statistics and things like that, a lot of the time anxiety is really prevalent in girls and women, but, you know, particularly kind of those 30s to 40s when it comes to women. And looking at our young people, looking at what they experience, I think that a lot of children are told they are shy. You know, by their grown-ups, and from a place of love and care, and from us all wanting the very best for our young people. You know, we look at them and we speak what our mind says. You know, we're like, oh, are you feeling shy, or are you? And we think of shyness as this negative characteristic that our young people share, you know, but actually shyness has its place. We are built to be cautious beings. It's a survival technique, and thankfully so. You know, what we want is our children to assess a situation and then decide actively whether they want to partake in it. And actually, you know, sometimes I think that the word shy is used when a grown-up feels that a child is not going in head first. But I always urge grown-ups to try and reframe it and replace that word with cautious. And, you know, when we work with the adults that we work with, whether you're in education, a nursery practitioner, wherever you are, or a parent or carer, thinking about shyness, really what we're thinking about is your child assessing a situation, not feeling particularly ready to involve themselves in it, and just taking a beat. And, you know, I always say to, I have a toddler as well, and I always say to him, you know, you'll know when you're ready. Because we want them to trust those emotions. And one of the biggest challenges is when our young people are told to, you know, come on, you're fine. get in there, you know. And then they're like, oh, I must be okay, but I don't feel okay. And of course, this then starts that second guessing of self, that second guessing and overriding of emotions, whereas all emotions are signposts, if you like, to something that doesn't feel right or doesn't necessarily feel like it serves you. So we don't want our children to ignore that, but we do want them to feel empowered in that moment. So I think, you know, shyness and anxiety, yeah, absolutely. If a child is feeling anxious about something, then they're going to be more cautious, aren't they? Because they don't feel they can do it, or, you know, that feeling doesn't feel good. Anxiety doesn't feel like a positive emotion a lot of the time. So yes, they might hold back, but I think how we frame that for our children can really help shifting that emotional state.
Following on from that, are there things that I'm sort of want to split it into sort of school and then parents and caregivers? Are there specific things that schools, parents, carers in partnership, I think I'm trying to say, are there things that those groups of people can do specifically to alleviate, or I don't know, I don't want to sort of dismiss the social anxiety, but it's almost as if, yes, the child's in the setting, yes, the child is in the same room as other children. What sort of practical things could be put in place to make that child's experiences more manageable, I think I'm trying to say.
I love that, Simon. And you know, one of the things that I am absolutely passionate about, and I know you know this already, but for those of you listening, I am so passionate about that 360 approach. In fact, it's why we set up the Behaviour Bank in the first place, which is the first and only currently online portal that bridges homes and settings with a 360 approach. So we've got a whole host of experts on there, from nutritionists to sleep coaches to speech and language therapists, because we are so, so passionate about that collective approach. You know, it does take a village to support a child, because we have to meet all those needs. And I think, you know, when we look at how we can support our young people as they go into a nursery or a school, even, you know, as we look at the older ones, it's always about building familiarity, isn't it? Building a safe space internally so that they can experience the external world in a way that feels good to them. So when we look at particularly starting, you know, in reception or the younger ones, taking something that is familiar from home into that setting is always a great go-to. It might be that they have a favourite toy, or if you're worried about them losing it, then a second favourite toy. But whatever it is that brings them comfort and joy and security emotionally is always a great way to bridge. You know, it might be that you do some pre-talk around where they're going, who will be there. I know that one of the strategies that I often offer the parents that I work with is to ask, you know, and the practitioners alike, is to share photographs of where the child will be in the setting, who the members of staff will be in the setting, you know, and of course mentioning that sometimes people get sick and there might be another member of staff, you can tell me about them, you know, afterwards, sort of thing. So of course there will always be that curveball when they're like, oh my goodness, that person wasn't there. But I think here we're thinking about how we can bridge those two places so that they're not a separate entity. And I think too often we have them as separate worlds for our children. And of course, when you start separating things out, that increases anxiety because the level of control that they have in those moments, let's face it again, you know, they don't have much control in the world when they're young. So if we can try and increase those levels of control, can they choose what goes in their snack box? Can they choose what socks they wear? What can we do to empower them and bridge those two settings so that their internal world feels, you know, like it's got this, like it can manage the situation no matter what comes its way.
Yeah, I'm interested to know your take on, I suppose there's two parts to this. One on sort of having conversations about social anxiety with children or in front of children, because we've talked about working in partnership. Do you think it's a positive thing for educators and parents to talk about social anxiety with the children, in front of the children? What's your experience with that?
I think how you talk about it matters whether they're there or not. You know, and how you see it, you know, really matters. So if you are having a conversation with a child about how they are feeling, it's so valuable, you know, and you can lean in on some of your past experiences to really connect about it. You can help them to talk it through, you know, identify things that might trigger that emotion and change their behavior, of course, because a lot of the time, those emotions do shift different behavior patterns. And, you know, some of the children will show that in a really big way and some will show that really in those small manners, those little mannerisms that we pick up on. But I think here it's about, how are you framing it and is it useful? I always say that there are three questions, and I use this with my own family as well. There are three questions to always ask. Is it kind? Is it helpful? And is it healthy? You know, and that, you know, that's the whole body, the brain included, right? So if you're talking about social anxiety, any big emotion, are you talking about it in a way that is useful? Are you talking about it in a way that is healthy for them to see it, you know, and to think about it? Is it going to make them feel empowered? And is it kind? Because sometimes I think even when we talk about things when children aren't there, we don't mean to be unkind, but some of our own thoughts about the world and our own experiences creep on in, and we can unconsciously say things that we wouldn't say to the child, you know, or we wouldn't say to each other if we were feeling that. So just having those three check-in points, I think, is really useful when you're talking about any feeling or any behavior.
I think building on from that, I think this more comes from a personal sort of place, and I see it more often when I'm on my travels as a visiting teacher. I think in some settings, there's this sort of ideal notion that, you know, the best way for children to work is always with like another child or in a group of children and so on. And I think there's some mileage for, you know, if a child expresses a desire to work on their own or to play with their own choice of things, I think that idea, I mean, I'm all for it. If I see a child on their own and they're fully engaged in their play and they don't invite you over, that's their choice. But I think this sort of push on, you know, for children to always be working together or to always be sitting with somebody else. For some children who are anxious about being with other people, I think it's important that they have the space in which to work how they feel best. I know that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I worked with a young girl a couple of years ago now. Gosh, that time's gone really quickly. And she really suffered with anxiety. She refused to come to school on many occasions. She'd walk through the gate in floods of tears most days. And actually, she was writing herself suicidal notes, and they hadn't told me. I probably wouldn't have worked with her had I known, because that would have been a little bit above what I deal with, generally speaking, you know, and would have referred her on. So I started to work with this girl, and one of the things that the head teacher had shared with me was exactly that. You know, she doesn't want to interact with other people. She won't play with others on the playground. She doesn't want to come to school. The list was pretty long in terms of what they were seeing. And when I started to work with her, so we did some confidence and communications coaching with this girl, and within the second session, she started to open up a little bit. And by the end of the program, she had basically kind of shared her journey and why she didn't want to engage. And there was quite a lot to unpick with her, absolutely. But one of the reasons that she didn't play on the playground was quite simply she didn't like their games and they didn't want to play hers. So it wasn't that she wasn't friends with those children. It was actually as simple as, I just don't dig it. I don't like the game that they are playing, so I'd rather read my book or do something else. And so one of the things that we set up in, so when we talk about areas, I use something called a balance zone or a balance area, rather than a calm area. And the reasoning behind that, if you like, is because we are constantly using and generating different emotions and different energies throughout the day. There are some times you need to activate your body. You need to tap in to a bigger surge of energy than others. So I'm a firm believer that we don't want children in a constant calm state. This is not it's not a positive learning state. So we want a balanced zone that does, you know, one or the other, and kind of they can ebb and flow throughout the day. And what we did was we set up an area outside in that school. They already had it in the classrooms because they're one of our TBBS schools. And she would go to the zone that we set up, and she would either use, you know, one of the bigger activities, the higher, you know, muscle, the bigger muscle activities, or for the higher energy, or she would go to grab a book or, you know, whatever, and she'd go and sit down. And actually by the end of the sessions, she had other children joining her that also didn't really like the games that they were playing, but they didn't want to play the games that she was offering. I mean, you know, I don't know what it was that she was offering, but it wasn't going down well with her friends. And they simply just started to spend that time reading and having a little chat and, you know, not playing and running around or climbing on the climbing frame, but just chilling out. And I think, you know, allowing children space to recognize their likes and dislikes without having that, oh, but I should. You know, I should play with those children, you know, and I hear it quite a lot, you know, when teachers or practitioners will say, you know, why aren't you playing with your friends? Where are your friends? Do you know, and they try and kind of create this forced play. And sometimes actually just giving another option, you know, thinking, okay, if you don't want to play with your friends, that's okay. You know, we don't have to always play the same games and do the same things as each other. And that's perfectly human.
I think that brings very nicely to the point that we've got to, if a child's presenting with social anxiety or in fact any other neurodivergency, then we need to celebrate the unique strengths of that particular individual rather than having to, you know, you're adhering to the neurotypical norms all the time. And your example of that particular child just exemplifies that so nicely, that here's the child, that this is what they're presenting with, and giving that child the voice. And it also makes me wonder, I think there's a crossover between potentially social anxiety and sensory overload. The sensory overload coming from, you know, going to a social event, and you've got to contend with the audio from the people talking, you've got like different environment and whatever, And I'm just thinking, it just makes me think of children and things like, you know, going to friends' birthday parties or going to other events or things like that, where, again, sometimes that's the expected thing to do. But I don't know if it's increasingly more common now for, you know, if a parent knows or a carer knows that a child's coming with, you know, some kind of neurodivergency, that there's some increasingly... there's increasing adaptions made for those particular children. I don't know if that's becoming more commonplace or whether there's still more to do in that respect.
I think this is, you know, a huge conversation that is so desperately, you know, needed, because when we're feeling anxious, you know, we have worry or fear, don't we? It's a fear. It's a fear, and most, you know, most anxieties, most fear is either something happening or not happening, or, you know, not knowing what that might look like. And I think, you know, whether we have children who have diagnosis, or, you know, whether children just want to kind of play by themselves, whether they want to play by a group but are struggling, I think really here in my very humble opinion, we just need inclusive environments, so that regardless of needs and regardless of emotional drive, our children are set up for success through the environments that we provide. You know, I'm a massive believer, a firm believer, that when we set up our classrooms, when we set up our homes, we do that with everything in mind, with all needs in mind, you know, because whether they respond to something one day and not the other, there has to be something in place for them in that moment. So there always needs to be an alternative, because we're all human, you know, and every human has a host of needs at any one time. And I think, you know, there's so much, and obviously, you know, the conversation in the council fairly recently was one that's really kind of sparked curiosity, shall we say, a little bit of fun. For lots of people, myself included. And I think that the trouble and the challenge is that we come back to defining, you know, to identifying. Mm-hmm. But actually, if we just recognize that every human has all the needs at different points and different kind of surges and different energy levels, then that inclusive environment is set up for all anyway, you know, and we can have a neuroaffirming approach to all of the things that we do. And it doesn't mean that any child is, you know, well, this is for you because, you know, there's that whole sensory basket, and I don't know how long you guys have been teaching or in education, but I've been around the educational wheel a few times now. And that, you know, that idea that those baskets are only for one particular child, you know, when you feel it, you can use it. And actually, you know, that's really quite the opposite to what we want, isn't it? You know, an inclusive environment is not that everyone is accepting of that one child. It is that everyone accepts that everyone needs something. And whatever that is, it needs to be met. And the timing is always going to be different. And I think, you know, that for me is probably the biggest part of my mission in the world when it comes to changing the education system, or at least supporting it, is that everything we do at home and in settings needs to be fully inclusive, regardless of the children on paper. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose my final question would be around parents. So if there were a parent maybe listening to this podcast, and maybe they've recognised social anxiety or general anxiety within their child, what would your advice be for that parent in terms of the first step or the first thing that they can do to support that?
This is such a great question. And, you know, I actually do a lot of work with this in our parental strategy sessions, because a lot of the time I will start the sessions with getting our parents to write down all of their own fears. Mm. because when we see our children feeling uncomfortable, worried, scared, you know, having those anxious, expressions, the first thing that happens to us as parents and carers is that our fear gets triggered, our concerns get triggered. You know, we worry that they won't fit in, we worry they won't have friends, we worry that they, you know, might be seen in a particular way, or that they'll be unhappy, or that, you know, the list of worries and fears as a parent or carer is quite extensive. And of course, if your child is showing some signs of having those fears also, it can be really difficult. So I always say, you know, start with you. Co-regulation is one of the biggest platforms of support. So if your child is showing and sharing anxiety and, you know, a concern about the situation or the setting, the biggest thing you can do is start with yourself. Think about anything that you have going on with your nervous system, anything that you might be, you know, holding really tight to your chest. And then from there, see what might be kind of flowing out into the world, because sometimes that happens, because we do co-regulate constantly. So whether we're doing it, you know, with intention or not, that will happen. We are all meant to connect like that. You know, that's part of the beauty of humanness. And then from there to start to think, okay, if that happens then, because as I said before, if we can start to plot things ahead of time, we increase that sense of control, that certainty, you know, and one of the six human needs is certainty. And for our young people, it's one of the biggest ones. So if we can start to think, right, okay, these are the fears I'm having, these are the emotions I'm having because of them, these are the things that you might be a little bit worried about, these are the emotions you're having, how do we make that better, how do we set something out ahead of time? So if you have a child that gets cautious and, you know, shies away from things, how do you empower them in that moment? What will bring their confidence out? What will allow them to feel safe? If you have a child that gets from 0 to 100 with anger, because of course, you know, we don't think about that when it comes to anxiety, but that is often something that we see in terms of behavior when it comes to anxiety. How do we allow them to take a breather and come back? You know, putting those, we call them positive outs, putting those positive outs in place ahead of time means that that's just a ticked box in their head. You know, well, I know what to do if that happens, and I know what to do if this happens. So they can feel that sense of security, that sense of certainty when they are walking into that setting. And they know that if it doesn't go right, they know what their next step is. They know what they're going to do about it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much. Today, I think it's been really useful. I'm sure parents and educators will probably learn a lot from this podcast. In terms of, I suppose, ways to find you, ways to contact you, where can people look?
So, of course, like everyone, we are on all of the socials in the world. So you can find us on Instagram at SPD Tuition and Coaching. You can find us online at SPD Tuition and Coaching. We haven't got a direct link to the Behaviour Bank if you Google it. But if you go to the website, you will find that we deliver training and we come into schools. We, you know, support parents and carers via our strategy sessions. So you can reach out through any of those, and you can, of course, pick up the phone. I'm a little bit old fashioned still. You can always pick up the phone and give us a call and have a chat. I know that's not something that we tend to do these days, but I do welcome the voices on the other end.
All remains to us to say is thank you so much for your time, Sam. It's been a very, very enlightening and very productive conversation. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks again, Sam.